see why the entropy of the reduced Sensi matrix is exactly this reversible rate at which you can exchange non-maximally entangled states and maximally entangled states. So we talked about this last time. And then the next thing we're going to talk about, which we'll get to at least some of today, is quantum error correction. So this is a new topic where we're going to look at quantum states and how we can protect them against the effects of noise, if they're in contact with some environment and then they're being made noisy through that interaction. Okay, so let's start with Schumacher compression. So the idea here is that, we want to compress a quantum source. And so, the idea is that we're given a source of quantum states. They could be pure quantum states. They could be mixed quantum states. But the sort of information that we're going to have about the nature of the source is that the states will have a certain reduced density matrix. So, if we average over, there will be different quantum states that will occur with different probabilities. And if we average over the probability distribution of the states that we get, then the reduced density matrix will be some particular density matrix rho. So and now we would like to understand, how well could we compress that source. So if that source was really a source of classical states, so if the way you achieved this density matrix was by taking some average over, states in some fixed basis, states in the computational basis with different probabilities, then the problem would really be exactly what we had before, right? That would just be the compression of classical information. And to understand what's going on here, you really almost don't have to understand much more than that. Because the idea is basically that we can just think about what happens if we diagonalize the density matrix, right? So if we diagonalize, then rho is some Hermitian matrix, so we can always diagonalize it, and we can write it as the sum of some eigenvalues lambda I. These things will form a probability distribution because rho is positive semi-definite, and the lambdas have to sum to 1. So it's the sum of the lambda I's times some eigenvectors, and let me call the eigenvectors psi sub I. So we can always do that. And now, there is this freedom in how a density matrix is realized that we've talked about before. So it's not necessarily, the interpretation of rho doesn't have to be that the way it was created was that the state lambda I was created, the state psi I was created with probability lambda I. That's just one possible way to realize this density matrix. There are infinitely many other possibilities that could have been the way that the density matrix was actually realized, to the extent that that means anything at all. But any of those realizations of the density matrix are, they're indistinguishable from the one in which the pure state psi I was created with probability lambda I. So so without loss of generality, we can just imagine that that's what the source is, right? And that's sort of the main observation. It suffices to code for a source that sends lambda I with probability, that sends psi I with probability lambda I. Okay, so now what are we going to do, right? If we imagine that we transform into the eigenbasis of rho, then it's basically just like we're doing classical encoding, okay? So if you just think about, what we're going to do is do a classical encoding of what these states are, then it's not surprising that the rate at which we could do that encoding would be the entropy of the probability distribution given by the lambda I's, which, after all, just is the Shannon entropy of the density matrix rho. So, but let's think a little bit more about what that strategy means in terms of, thinking in more quantum terms of what we're going to do on the density matrix. So something that we can imagine that we do is, first of all, let's take this density matrix and we'll project it onto what we call the typical subspace. Right, so we had this notion of typical sequences before, that if we had some states that we were sending, which were just classical states, and we considered those bit strings that were the ones that had, that were most likely to occur, which would be the ones that had about the expected Hamming weight for whatever the given source is, then we could almost just assume that we had such a string, because we would get such a string with very high probability if we consider the asymptotic limit where we take long strings that come from this source, right? So let's do that. Here's our strategy. We're going to project onto the typical subspace of the state that we get when we take n copies, right? So we're going to do asymptotics. We're going to imagine that we're encoding n symbols. And the density matrix for n symbols is, of course, just the, you know, since we're considering a quantum IID source, the density matrix for a message where we sample n times from this distribution is just rho tensor n. So what is the typical subspace of rho tensor n? Well, that's going to be the subspace that's spanned by tensor products of these eigenvectors, psi I, that have the property that their probability is typical, right? So this is going to be, so what do I mean by typical sequences? An eigenvector of rho tensor n is epsilon typical if the probability with which it occurs is close to the expected value. So more precisely, what does that mean? So the expected value would be 2 to the minus n times the von Neumann entropy of rho, right? Because the von Neumann entropy of rho is just the entropy of these probabilities that occur when you diagonalize the density matrix. And so we'll say that the eigenvector is epsilon typical if the associated eigenvalue is close to that expectation. Okay, so if 2 to the minus n times the entropy of rho plus epsilon, so epsilon is the, you know, quantifies how far away from the you know, kind of ideal expected value we are. So if the eigenvalue of rho tensor n, which is some product of the lambda I's, so let me just write product of lambda, it's some, you know, product of the eigenvalues associated with each of the tensor factors, is less than or equal to 2 to the minus n times the entropy of the density matrix plus epsilon. So this is, oh, sorry, I guess minus epsilon. So this is just the analog of the sort of expression that we had when we were talking about not an eigenvector, but just a sequence of bits being epsilon typical. Okay. So now, what happens if we project onto the typical subspace? So if we're going to do this, we're going to, in general, change the state, right? When I say project onto the typical subspace, what I mean is we perform the measurement, the von Neumann measurement that gives us the outcome either yes, we're in the subspace, or no, we're not in the subspace. So just that two outcome measurement. And when you do that, well, there's some probability that you get the atypical outcome, that you're not in the typical subspace. But that's going to happen with very small probability. What's much more likely to happen is that you'll find yourself in the typical subspace. And when you do that, you'll hardly change the state at all, because the state is almost entirely in the typical subspace. I can either say that I'm post-selecting on the typical subspace, or that I'm making this measurement and seeing what outcome I get. But I almost always get the yes outcome, the outcome that I am in a typical subspace. So we almost always find ourselves in the typical subspace. And if you want to calculate how likely it is, it's just the same kind of calculation you have to do for classical data compression. And if we project onto the typical subspace, we hardly change the state. And again, you can quantify this in the same way that you would quantify things for classical data compression. Okay, now once we're in the typical subspace, we know that our state can be described by specifying some typical sequence of eigenvectors, right? We can specify the labels on these states psi sub I, and we know that we're in the typical subspace, so we know that they form a typical sequence. And so we only have to code for the typical eigenvectors. So after projecting, we know that the state lives in the typical subspace, so we can describe it with a smaller number of qubits. So how many qubits do we need? Well, the number of states that we need is like the log of the dimension of the typical subspace. That's how many qubits we need. So what is that number? So what's the dimension of this typical subspace? So how many qubits do we expect to need to encode? So we have, you know, we've got this source row, and we're going to take n symbols from that source, and we want to compress that down to fewer than n qubits, right? And so what's the thing that's going to govern, you know, how many qubits we need? Yeah, it's going to have to do with the spectrum of rho, but so what property of the spectrum of rho? The entropy, right. The entropy should be what matters, right? So the question is just how many typical sequences there are. The number of typical sequences is, you know, the number of epsilon typical sequences, of course, depends on epsilon, but only weakly. And so, you know, for some constant epsilon up to small factors, the number of epsilon typical sequences is going to be basically the entropy, right? This is what we saw in the classical case. And now it's exactly the same thing. You know, if we want to look at the typical subspace and calculate its dimension, it's enough to just ask how many typical sequences of eigenvectors there are. You know, how many typical eigenvectors there are, and it's going to be exactly the entropy of the eigenvalues of the density matrix, right? So this is just, you know, if we're doing this for some particular value n, then this is going to be, well, I can't say equal to, but it's going to be approximately n times s of rho. And, you know, it's only really close to this in the limit that n is large, and there are some, you know, it's not exactly this, and there's some deviation that has to do with how big epsilon is, but if you take a constant epsilon and you take n to infinity, then this thing approaches, well, you know, and you divide this thing by n, you know, then as n goes to infinity, the limit will be the entropy of rho. Okay. So this is really just exactly the same thing as we have in the classical setting. And there's a theorem which is very much analogous to Shannon's noiseless coding theorem that we can state. You know, and maybe I just, you know, in the interest of time, maybe I won't even bother to write down the statement. You can just kind of transform the statement that you had before. But there's a theorem which is, which was, you know, first stated by Ben Schumacher, which basically says that everything goes through like this when we consider quantum sources and we do quantum encoding. So we can call an encoding of quantum states reliable if the encoding gives us a fidelity with the initial state that approaches 1 as n goes to infinity. And, you know, the rate is just the number of qubits that we have to encode into. So if we encode n qubits into n times r qubits, then we say that r is the rate. And there's this theorem that says that, well, you know, if you try to encode at a rate above the entropy, right? So if you try to encode into more than this number of qubits, then there will exist a scheme that's reliable. And if you would try to encode at a better rate, so you try to encode in dramatically fewer than this number of qubits, then any scheme that has that rate will not be reliable. Okay, so it's exactly the same statement that we had before, but now it's about encodings of quantum sources. Questions about that? Okay, so then the next thing, you know, related to this that I wanted to talk about has to do with, you know, entanglement concentration and dilution. So let me remind you what the situation was there. So, you know, what we did is we looked at bipartite quantum states. So we had some state, you know, some pure state of two systems, A and B. And we said that we could quantify the entanglement of such a state as the entropy of the reduced density matrix of either A or B. They have the same entropy, so it doesn't really matter which one we take. So we could say, I don't know, trace over B. Right. So that was supposed to be some measure of the entanglement of a bipartite pure quantum state. And there was this question of, you know, if we have some state and we want to interconvert that state and some standard form of entanglement, so we just take, like, you know, the standard maximally entangled state, you know, 0, 0, plus 1, 1 over root 2, what's the rate at which we can interconvert those states? And it turns out you can reversibly interconvert those states when you do things asymptotically, that you take n copies of the state and you try to convert n copies of this state to some number of copies of the maximally entangled state and vice versa. And, you know, what we had before was that, well, if we wanted to concentrate entanglement, you know, so if we want to take the state psi and we want to convert that, well, we take n copies of psi and we want to convert that to, say, the state that we called beta 0, 0, so just 0, 0 plus 1, 1 over root 2, then you could convert this to n times the entanglement of psi you know, that's how many EBITs you could get out. And if you wanted to go the other way around, well, you could also do that. So there's some way of doing this using only local operations and classical communication. And, you know, so this is a reversible process. You know, there will be some small losses, but if you take n to be large, then you can essentially reversibly interconvert these states, right? So this is what I argued before as, you know, what I said was the case before as a way of arguing that this was a good measure of entanglement because it really quantifies how you can convert psi to some standard entangled state. And at least in this asymptotic setting, what this means is that there's really only one kind of bipartite pure state entanglement, namely the kind in beta 0, 0, because you can always use that as your standard currency for entanglement. And so now we're in a position to see why this is the case. Right, at least if we believe, you know, I mean, module of the details that we haven't filled in about, you know, about how you can compress quantum data. Right. So this is called concentration. This is called dilution, and let's look at those two things separately. Okay, so first, concentration. So let's see how we can take, you know, so the idea now is that we're given n copies of some quantum state psi, and we would like to turn that into maximally entangled states. We'll get fewer copies in general than we started with because these are states that have more concentrated entanglement. Okay, so how can we do that? Well, so the first thing to do to kind of understand what's going on is to write down the what's called the Schmidt decomposition of the quantum state. Is this something you've seen before? Okay, good. So so this is like, you know, so you can always write some quantum state as a sum over like different labels for the two states. But in fact, by doing some kind of singular value decomposition, you can always write it like this. Right? So if you have a bipartite state, you can always come up with some probability distribution with probabilities p sub I and some states for the two registers, you know, the A and the B registers held by the two parties, such that the state looks like this. I guess I could write it like this. Okay, so this is called the Schmidt decomposition. And now what we can do is, you know, see what can we say about the Schmidt decomposition of, you know, not psi, but n copies of psi, because that's what we actually have when we want to do entanglement concentration. And it's really important that we be able to do these asymptotics. Okay, so let's look at psi tensor n. Well, if we want to look at that state, you know, we can get the Schmidt decomposition of that state just by, you know, taking the Schmidt decomposition of the individual states and tensoring them up. So here we're going to get the sum over, like, you know, I1 through IN of root P1 through PN. Here we have I1 through IN for Alice and I1 through IN for Bob. So this is not necessarily the standard basis. I mean, I guess I'm simplifying the notation a little bit. You know, this is whatever is the kind of the Schmidt state for Alice, whatever is the Schmidt state for Bob. They could be general states, but I mean, they're related by some unitary transformation that we could do locally anyway. So, I think it's okay if we just label them like this. It's clear what's going on. So now this is the Schmidt decomposition for the state that we have when we take n copies. Okay. So now, you know, we have this probability distribution, these p's, and so what we would like to do is we would like to somehow perform some operation on this state that we can perform locally. So we can't do a global unitary transformation in the whole state, but what we can do is operations that, you know, just look at the A part or just look at the B part, and we can also communicate back and forth. And, you know, what we'd like to do is some operation of that kind that will make this state look like a maximally entangled state, right? So what could we do? What would be some operation we could do that would make this state look more like a maximally entangled state? And now we want it to look like a maximally entangled state, you know, not just of one qubit, but of many qubits, right? So we would like, what's the sort of state we would like it to look like? You know, the Schmidt decomposition for a d-dimensional maximally entangled state would be like, you know, we basically just want all of the Schmidt coefficients, all of these probabilities to be uniform, right? So like a d-dimensional maximally entangled state would look like this. So we want the state to look like that, where like the Schmidt coefficients have been made more uniform, right? So how can we you know, manipulate this state so that it looks more like a you know, a maximally entangled state? Any ideas? We're going to use something similar to what we did before. Maybe that's helpful. And okay, so here's another hint. So, you know, we expect to be able to get out, you know, let's look at what the answer is supposed to be, right? We expect to be able to get out a number of copies of the maximally entangled state that goes like n times the entanglement of that state. What is the entanglement of that state? Well, it's just the entropy of the reduced density matrix. And do you know what the reduced density matrix is if you have a Schmidt decomposition like this? What are the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix? They're just the PIs, right? So the density matrix, the reduced density matrix for A is just like, you know, the sum over I, PI, I, I, right? That's just what you get if you trace out B. You take this thing with, you know, times its adjoint and you trace out B, you just get this. Or, you know, this would be the A states or the B states depending on which side you traced out, right? So this is the reduced density matrix. So the answer that we are looking for is the entropy of the reduced density matrix, which is just the Shannon entropy of this probability distribution, right? Okay, so now what should we do to try to make the state look more like a maximally entangled state? And what's the dimension of that entangled state? Well, it should be, the dimension that we're looking for is like the entropy of this probability distribution. Well, n times the entropy of that probability distribution, because we've done this on n copies. So what can we do? I can't help you any more than this. We should do that. Yeah, we should project onto the typical subspace. Exactly. Right. So, you know, we have, you know, there are some sequences I1 through IN that are typical in the sense that this probability is close to its expected value. And let's just project onto those, right? So the message we've seen so far is that if we think about, you know, some IID source, you know, so we have some IID source of symbols, then if we, you know, if we look at the ones that are most likely, we just sort of focus on the typical sequences, then those typical sequences will all have about the same probability, and the probability that they have will be like, you know, 1 over 2 to the n times the entropy of the probability distribution. So this is exactly what we do. So we'll project... you can project either one side or the other onto the typical subspace. It doesn't matter. I mean, if you project just one side onto the typical strings, then you're going to collapse the whole thing because, both Alice and Bob could do the projection, but they don't have to. So we're going to project, you know, either part onto the typical subspace. Right? In order to do this, well, you know, that's just some projection that you know how to do if you know what the Schmidt basis is, which, you know, so the assumption here is that you know what the state is that you have. So this is some projection that you can do. You perform the projection onto the typical subspace. And now what you have is something where the probabilities are pretty close to uniform. Okay, so you might think that this state sort of looks like a maximally entangled state. It's not exactly this. You have some variation in the probabilities, though. And so here's some place where I have to kind of just wave my hands a little bit because we're not doing things in enough detail, and you can't really see what's going on from the level of detail that we've done. But it turns out that what you get if you just project onto the typical subspace is not quite enough. The distribution is not quite uniform enough for this thing to be close to a maximally entangled state in the sense that the fidelity will be close to 1. So you actually have to do a little bit more measurement to get things to actually work out, which is that you have to measure what's called the type class. So that's like, if these things are zeros and ones, that's like the Hamming weight of this string. So we also have to measure the type class. So this is like the Hamming weight of I1 through IN, or more generally, if these things were not bits, you would have to just measure like the frequencies with which each symbol would occur. So if you do that, now you're going to get something where actually all of the coefficients are exactly the same. Because what you have are, you know, if you have two strings that have exactly the same Hamming weight, then the probabilities of those two strings will be exactly the same. So then you'll really get something where literally all of the amplitudes are the same. However, you will project further. So you'll project onto a smaller space, but you actually won't throw away much dimension, right? So they're only, you know, they're only a polynomial number of different Hamming weights, and so you're only going to lose some, you know, logarithmic factor in terms of the, you know, amount of entanglement that you get. So it's basically not going to affect things at all as far as the asymptotics go. So so now all strings, you know, all strings that remain after you do this projection, so I1 through IN, have the same amplitude, which is what we want for a maximally entangled state. And you can show, you know, if you do a bit of calculation, that the dimension of the subspace that you're in with high probability is still close to n times the entropy. Right? Or rather, I guess the dimension is close to 2 to the n times the entropy, so the number of qubits of entanglement that you have, the number of e-bits that you have, is close to n times the entropy. So the dimension is still close to 2 to the n times s of rho, or let me write 2 to the n times the entanglement of the state. Okay, so you know the fact that you still have about that much dimension when you just project onto the typical subspace is really the same fact that we talked about over here. But then there's a little bit more calculation you have to do to understand what happens when you measure a type class. But you know, maybe it's not too surprising that that what happens is you don't throw away much dimension when you do that. Okay, so that's entanglement concentration. Questions about that?
Yeah, I'm having trouble seeing what the difference between the projection and the measured steps are. So it seems like if you were to measure the type class from the start, you'd end up with things that all have the same probability.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, I guess something you could say, let's not bother with this step. I mean, this is a step that somehow when you do it, you're not doing anything almost, because you almost always get the outcome that says yes. So if you didn't do it, I mean, it's almost like, you know, it doesn't really, I mean, this is sort of more for, you know, understanding things conceptually than doing some operation that really affects things a lot. And indeed, if you just measure the type class from the outset, you know, there are some type classes that are typical and some type classes that are atypical. The really low or the really high Hamming weight strings, I mean, anything that deviates very much from the, you know, the typical classes, which is that, you know, if you've got a probability p, then, you know, you would expect like n times p1s. Anything that deviates by very much from that, it's not likely to occur when you measure the type class. So, you know, if you know what the type class is, you know whether that's a typical or an atypical type class. And so you could just forget about this. And from this information, you could infer the same thing you would get from this. Is that okay? The difference between, you know, this kind of step and this kind of step is that here you're really not doing much. I mean, your state already is almost entirely in the typical subspace. When you measure the type class, there are different outcomes that you could get. You know, if the expected number is p times n, you could get p times n, you could get p times n plus 1, you get p times n minus 17. Those things will all have, you know, some comparable probabilities. But you do need to make that measurement, and you do get some information that then you can use in order to you know, you do also, you know, once you do that, you have to post-process the state to get it into some kind of standard form. But you know what state you got out because you knew what psi was, you knew what the distribution was, you know what type class you measure. So there's some unitary you can perform locally that's going to get you to a state of this form.
I mean, I see why we want to measure the type class. I don't see why we want to. I don't see what we gain by before that.
You don't gain anything, so don't do it if you don't want to. Sure, but that's right. It doesn't make things any better. I mean, in terms of the, like, you know, from a practical standpoint, like, you know, how likely you are to succeed, it's not going to affect anything. Yeah, that's true. Okay, good. So that's the concentration step. And then the other step is dilution. So here you see we didn't actually need, I mean, we wanted to show that all of this was possible by LOCC, where we do local operations in classical communication. Actually, here we didn't really need any communication, except maybe, you know, if you wanted to be able to say, well, you don't even need that to say whether you've got the good outcome, because of course, you know, if Alice measures the type class and Bob also measures the type class, they're guaranteed to get the same thing, right? Because you know, because this is some entangled state, and this is sort of the you know, that's just a property of the Schmidt basis. So there's actually no communication which is needed in this protocol. But for entanglement dilution, we actually will need to communicate. Okay, So for entanglement dilution, what you want to do is the other way around, right? So now you're given n times the entanglement of psi copies of a maximally entangled state, and from that you want to be able to create n copies of psi. And this is actually pretty easy to do. You know, basically what you can do is, so Alice creates the state, you know, so she wants to create, she wants, they want to ultimately have these n copies of psi, right? So Alice is going to create psi AB tensor N locally, right? So when I write, you know, AB, I mean, Alice is holding both of these subsystems. The A subsystem is one that she's always going to keep, and the B subsystem is a subsystem that she would like Bob to have, but initially she's got it in her lap, okay? So she knows what the state is. She can just create this entire state locally. And now, somehow, she would like to send the B part to Bob. So they have a resource, right, which is that they have n times the entanglement of psi copies of beta 0,0, right? So something that she could do would be that she could try to just use, you know, and they have the ability to communicate, so they could just use teleportation, right? She could just take the B part and teleport that over to Bob, right? But to do that, you know, the B part is, you know, if psi is a state of a qubit, let's say, then the B part consists of n qubits, but she only has n times the entanglement of psi EPR pairs. So she couldn't send all of the n things over just by standard teleportation, right? So she has to do something more, right? So how can she take this state and somehow effectively teleport the B part over to Bob, despite the fact that she doesn't have enough EPR pairs? So she has this state. The B part somehow is taking up more space than it ought to, right? So she somehow wants to be able to send that B part over, you know, by some kind of teleportation. She has E of psi EPR pairs, well, N times E of psi EPR pairs that she can use, but that's not enough to just set it in the clear. So somehow she would like to make this B part smaller. So what can she do? Exactly. So what she should do is she should take the B part of this system and do Schumacher compression on it, right? If she compresses the B part of this system, that's something that has a density matrix whose entropy is S of rho. And we know from this stuff about Schumacher compression that you can reliably compress a state with density matrix rho tensor N down to a number of qubits that instead of N is just N times the entropy of rho. So what she does is she compresses the B part to N times, it'll be N times E of psi qubits. And then using LOCC and the fact that they share these N times E of psi copies of beta 0,0, she can do teleportation. So then teleport the B subsystem using N times E of psi EBITs. So then she'll consume the state beta 0,0, and the effect at the end of the day will be that they will share these N copies of psi AB. Well, you know, of course, there will be some small errors that are incurred in doing this, and there's all this kind of, you know, error analysis that you would have to do, but, you know, up to some errors which are small and will go to zero as N goes to infinity, if you treat them carefully, this will be the overall effect. All right, so questions about that? And here, you know, it really was essential that we had some communication because, you know, in order to do this teleportation, you need to have the entanglement, and then you need to send some classical message for what was the measurement outcome in teleportation. Okay, questions? All right, so that's it for this quantum information theory stuff. And now what we're going to do is we're going to go on and we're going to talk about quantum error correction. Okay, so now we have a new kind of you know, problem that we want to deal with, you know, which is the fact that if we have real systems, they're always going to be noisy, and you know, we're going to have some way of doing that. So we would like to be able to do reliable storage or reliable transmission of data, you know, even if we have errors. So we're going to think about this ultimately in the quantum context, where we have information stored in quantum states, and we would like to preserve that, or we'd like to be able to transmit those states reliably, even through noisy channels. But of course, there's an analogous problem even when we have classical information. So you could imagine that we have, you know, classical information that we want to store, or that we want to send, and we'd like to do that reliably, even though the channel might be noisy. And so there's this notion of error-correcting codes that allow you to do that. And these things are used even classically. So, for example, you know, on your cell phone, if you want to be able to send audio reliably back and forth, you know, the communications channel it's going over is noisy, and so the signal is being encoded into some kind of error-correcting code. It's going to somehow put some redundancy into the message so that you'll be able to decode it, even though some of the bits will get screwed up. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at the classical case. So, you know, we've got some noisy channel that we would like to send information over, and we would like the outcome of sending this data through this noisy channel to be reliable, even though some noise was added. So to do this, we have to somehow have some model for what the noise is going to be. So let's, just to get the idea for what's going on, let's start by considering the very simplest error model that you might consider, which is something called the binary symmetric channel. So this is a channel that just, you know, takes its input one bit and gives its output one bit. And it behaves as follows. So, you know, we either put in a 0 or a 1, and the correct thing will be transmitted with probability 1 minus p. So p will be the probability of an error. So 0 gets sent to 0 with probability 1 minus p, and 1 gets sent to 1 with probability 1 minus p. But with probability p, there's an error. So with probability p, a 0 is flipped to a 1, or a 1 is flipped to a 0. Okay, so p is the error probability. All right, so we're going to make a simplifying assumption, which is that the errors that occur on different bits are IID, so the same kinds of errors occur, and the distribution is the same, and the errors are independent. And now the kind of thing we're going to take advantage of for some model like this, if the error probability is small, so we're going to consider sort of, you know, we're going to really care about the limit where the error probability is not too big, because, you know, of course, if completely arbitrary errors could happen, there's just nothing you can do in general. If you just, you know, discard your message and replace it with something completely different, there's nothing you can do. So you have to make some kind of an assumption. And a nice and often reasonable assumption is just that the error probability is not too large. So we're going to imagine that the error probability is not too big, and we're going to try to see what we could do to code for that. I mean, actually, if the error probability were too big, you know, if it were really big, it would almost be like it being really small, right? Because if the error probability is like, you know, 99%, then it's just like a NOT gate is applied to your message, and then some small errors occur. And that's easy to correct for, too. But anyway, let's just imagine that we're in the regime where the error probability is small. So the idea is going to be that if the error probability is small and we send many symbols that are affected by this same noise, then if some error occurs, the most likely thing that will happen is that not many error occurs. So not many errors occur, or a low weight error will occur, right? So if we have, let's say, 3 bits that go through a channel like this and p is pretty small, then if there's some error, it's more likely that there was 1 error than that there were 2 errors. That's going to be the idea. And, you know, the simplest example of an error-correcting code that will work in this kind of situation is what's called the 3-bit repetition code. Okay, so the way that this code works is, you know, say you want to send a 0, well, you're going to encode that in 3 zeros. So, you know, this is like some abstraction of something you might do anyway if you're on the phone with someone and the connection is kind of bad, right? I mean, if you're worried that they might not hear you once, you might repeat yourself a few times and hope that at least one time it got through. Right? So this is going to be the kind of the encoding of a 0, and sometimes we'll write 0 sub L for logical 0 to write this expression, which is sometimes called a code word. So we encode 0 into the code word 000, which we can write as the logical 0. All right, and similarly, we're going to encode a 1 into 3 ones. And now the thing which is nice about this is that if one of the bits is, undergoes an error, so if one of the bits is flipped, then we can still decode, right? We can still figure out what message was sent. But now if you know, more errors occur, if it's likely that more than one error could occur, then we might be in trouble. But certainly if we know that either no errors occurred or one error occurred, then we can correctly recover. So we can do recovery by majority voting. So what we do we send like 0 0 0 back to 0. We would send 0 0 1 to 0, or 0 1 0 0, etc. And if it's 1 1 1, then we would say it should be 1. If it's like 1 0 1, then we would also send that to 1, etc. Right. So this majority voting procedure will work with some probability. I mean, it'll work correctly if there were either no logical errors or if there was one logical error. But if there are if there were either 0 or 1 errors on the individual bits, then there would be no logical error when we look at the level of the logical information that's stored. But now if we have either 2 or 3 errors on the physical bits, then there would be an error at the level of the logical bits. And so now what we can do is we can calculate the probability that we would get 2 or 3 errors, which would be the situation in which we would actually make a mistake when we do this decoding. So what is this? Well, we can just sum up the probabilities that we have either 2 errors or 3 errors. The probability that we have 3 errors would be p cubed, right? Because p is the probability that we have an error on any one bit. Things are independent. So the probability would just be p cubed that we have 3 errors. And the probability that we would have 2 errors would be, well, the probability for any one configuration of having those 2 errors would be like there would be a probability p squared associated with the 2 errors and a probability 1 minus p associated with the position that doesn't have an error. And there are 3 ways that we could not have an error, right? There are 3 positions on which the non-error could occur. So this is the probability that we have either 2 or 3 errors. And the kind of important thing to observe is that this is order p squared, right? If we think about the case where p is small, then this is something that goes like p squared. And so we would expect this to be quite a lot smaller than what would happen if we just didn't encode our bit, right? Then there would be a probability p of an error occurring. But now with this encoding, we have a probability of error that goes like p squared, which is better, right? That's smaller. Okay, so this is maybe like the simplest example of a classical error correcting code. There are many much more sophisticated codes than this. So you can do better than just encoding by repetition. You can encode things in more sophisticated ways. There's a whole very rich theory of error correcting codes where you can worry about all kinds of properties. What is the rate at which they allow you to encode? As compared with the sort of noise that they could correct for, what can you say about the efficiency of encoding and decoding, et cetera? You could take a semester-long course on this subject, and obviously we can't talk about it in a lot of detail now, but hopefully you get the idea for what is sort of meant by an error-correcting code, that you want some way of encoding your logical data into in some redundant way into more bits so that you can have some redundancy that allows you to correct against at least the situation where not too many errors occur. Well, I mean, I guess the analysis that we're doing here is just at the level of what are the errors that happen at the end of the day. So if some error occurs and then the same error occurs again to that bit, then that's great. I mean, then no error occurred if it was a bit flip error. Here, when I say 2 or 3 errors, what I mean is 2 or 3 like distinct errors. Yeah, I mean, the model I was considering here was that, for each of the bits independently, an error occurs or does not. If you had a different model where it's like you choose a bit, uniformly, and then you decide whether to have an error occur to it or not, then you might potentially pick the same bit twice, and then you would get into the situation you're talking about. This maybe, gets at an important point, which is that, in understanding what's, how well error correcting codes work, you have to understand what is the error model, right? So here was one error model, but you could consider different error models that would allow correlated errors or, would have other features. And, it would be maybe significant to understand what the error model was in order to design a good code for it. It's an important issue. And you know, we'll see that there's an issue of like, what is the right error model when we talk about quantum states in a bit. Okay, so this is you know, just the basic idea of classical error correcting codes. And you know, rather than go into more depth for you know sort of how classical error correcting codes work, maybe we should think about how we would make some kind of a quantum error correcting code, right? So you know, how would we do it at all? How would we even make some kind of analog of a simple classical error correcting code like this? So so how would we make a quantum error correcting code? And when you first sort of think about this, you know, as people first started doing in around 94, 95, or something like that, you know, it's not really obvious at first how you would do this at all. There are some problems that immediately come up, right? So first of all, the idea for how we would redundantly encode classical information here was to make multiple copies of the state. But clearly, that's not going to work quantumly, right? Because we can't clone quantum information. So so there's this no cloning. So there's no, you know, the most naive, at least, analog of something like this, where we just make three copies of the information. That's just not something we can do at all to quantum states. The second thing is that, you know, in order to do some kind of a correction here, we had to look, we had to get some information about the state, right? So what we would do is we would look at the three bits and we would decide, you know, are they a majority of zeros or a majority of ones to figure out how to decode. So we have to observe something about the information. But quantum mechanically, if we wanted to have a coherent superposition between these two possibilities, you know, if we had a state that was a superposition of 0 and 1, if we were to measure the information about you know, what the values of the bits are in order to figure out what the majority value is, if we measure too much, then we would disturb the state. We could remove the coherence that we had in the quantum state. So so determining the error will require some kind of a, well, it'll require collecting some information about the state. You would normally think about doing that by performing a measurement. So determining the error requires us to learn about the state. And you know, we have to worry about the disturbance that that might cause. And you know, the last thing that you have to worry about, which maybe seems like, you know, possibly going to be the worst problem of all, is that, you know, classically we had some small set of errors that we would have to correct for, right? So you know, if we encoded into three bits, then there are really only you know, three things that could happen. We could perform a bit flip on the first bit, a bit flip on the second bit, and a bit flip on the third bit, and then we could have combinations of those. But there's really just some small set of possible errors that might occur. But quantum mechanically, what is an error? An error could be a completely arbitrary transformation on the quantum state. It could be any unitary transformation, which is already some continuum of errors. But even more generally than that, it could be some kind of interaction with an environment that performs some quantum operation. And there's just, you know, a huge you know, universe of possibilities, you know, for what the errors could be. So so this is you know, why I said we have to think carefully about what the right error model should be. So we need to correct a continuum of errors. So if the idea is that what we want to do is somehow figure out what error occurred and then undo it, that seems like it's going to be really hard because we would have to collect some continuous amount of information to figure out what error occurred, and then you know, the operation that we might have to do to undo it could be very complicated. So so really just a lot of different kinds of errors that could occur. Like we talked about, you know, before about like, you know, phase damping or amplitude damping. We could have small rotations that could be applied to the state in addition to simple things like bit flips on the individual qubits. So how are we going to correct for all of this, you know, kind of complicated universe of errors? Okay. So so what we're going to do is we're going to kind of go by steps. So maybe let's first look at just these problems 1 and 2, where we only worry about encoding, where we only worry about creating an encoding that will correct against bit flip errors, right? So let's think about trying to encode quantum states in such a way that we can correct against bit flip errors. So if we try to do this, where the quantum state could be an arbitrary quantum state, we still have to deal with the fact that we can't just make a copy of the quantum state, because we want to deal with general superpositions as our states. And we still have this issue that we don't want to learn too much about the state because we don't want to disturb it. So let's first just try to create a quantum code that will correct against bit flip errors. Okay, so let's find a quantum code for bit flip errors. So we could consider, you know, a model of errors that could occur to our quantum state, where again, it's like we have this binary symmetric channel, but instead of it just acting on, on classical bits, we've got some quantum state, and with probability p independently for each of the qubits that we have in our system, we'll apply. So with probability p, we'll apply an x gate, and with probability 1 minus p, we'll do an identity gate. So that's our you know, very simple error model to try to handle first. Okay, so how can we do the encoding, despite the fact that we can't clone? Well, something that we can do is try to only copy information in one basis, right? We can't copy information in the sense of copying the whole quantum state, but we can always copy in a basis. And if we only want to protect against bit flip errors, then it's sufficient to do copying in the computational basis, right? So to deal with point one, what we want to do is copy only in the computational basis. Right, so in order to do this, you know, the kind of circuit for doing this would be quite simple. So we've got some general state of a qubit that we want to encode in some way that it'll be protected. And then we'll have some ancillas that we start out in the zero state. And we just do a C-naught. We just do some C-naughts from our state that we want to encode onto these ancillas. And now what's going to happen if we do this? Well, the state, if we think about how the computational basis states for psi would be encoded, 0 is going to get mapped to some logical 0 state, which is just 3 zeros. And 1 is going to get mapped to some logical 1 state, which is just 3 ones. And what's going to happen for a general superposition? Well, if we have, you know, alpha 0 plus beta 1, that's just going to get mapped to alpha 0, 0, 0 plus beta 1, 1, 1. And that's sort of the best we can hope for. You know, we can copy in the computational basis, and that's sort of the closest we can get to this sort of repetition code. Okay, so this is going to be our encoding for our quantum 3-bit repetition code. It's really just the classical code where we put kets around everything and say that things behave linearly. Okay? So now, what can we say about trying to do some error detection with this code? So now what we would like to do is we would like to imagine that we have information that's been encoded in this way, and then there's some, you know, there's going to be some error that occurs, and again, the model will be that the error rate is small, so the probability p is not too big, and we'd like to do something that's going to tell us what error occurred without destroying the coherence in the quantum state. And the kind of the slogan here for this part, the way we get around this problem that we don't want to measure too much, is that we want to measure the error without measuring the data. And it's possible to do this if you do the measurement carefully. So here's going to be the recovery procedure for this particular 3-qubit repetition code that we're talking about. So we've got our 3 physical qubits that are encoding our 1 logical qubit. And now what we're going to do is we're going to just measure certain parities of the bits, right? So if we want to be able to do this majority voting, it's sufficient just to be able to tell, well, we really just want to be able to compute what the majority was, but we also want to be able to do some corrections. So we want to know where the error was so we can fix it. And if we also want to get that additional information, it's enough to look at pairs of the bits and figure out whether they're the same or different. Right? So for example, these 2 bits are the same, but these 2 bits are different, so we know there's some error there. And if these 2 bits are the same and these 2 bits are different, it must actually be the third bit where the error occurred. Right? So so that's the sort of thing that we want to do. So what we'll do is we have our 3 bits of the encoding, and then we'll have 2 additional bits that we use to compute some parities. And what we're going to do is in the first bit, we're going to compute the parity of the first of these 2 what are called syndrome bits. We're going to compute the parity of the first 2 bits in our encoding, and in the last bit, in the second bit of the syndrome, we're going to compute the parity of the second and third bits of our encoding. So this is our, this is going to be our quantum circuit for recovery, where these things are initially zero. And what we have up here is some code word. We have some quantum state that's been encoded with that encoding, and then some error has potentially been applied to it. Okay. So then what we do is we create these two bits. We perform a measurement over here in the computational basis, and this gives us what's called the syndrome. So what comes out over here is the syndrome, and you know there are four possibilities that we could have, and we've got to figure out how we should interpret them, right? So if we have 0, 0 that comes out, right? So what that says is that the parity. So this bit, right? This thing here is the parity is going to tell us the parity of these two bits, right? Because this thing is flipped for this bit, flipped for this bit. So if these two bits are the same, this will be a zero, regardless of whether they're 0, 0 or 1, 1. And if it's 0, 1 or 1, 0, then this will be a 1, right? So if this bit is a 0 and this bit is also a 0, then what does that suggest, right? What sort of is the most likely error then that would have occurred to this logical qubit? Nothing, right. So this we should interpret as no error, right? Now the other three possibilities should tell us something about where a bit flip occurred, right? Because if some error occurred, the next most likely thing, if p is small, is that one error occurred. So what we would like to do is for each of these possibilities, work out under the assumption that one error occurred, where did that error most likely occur? Or I mean, where did that error occur, right? Under the assumption that there's one error, there's going to be one place that it would have occurred, right? So what about 0, 1? So that means that these two bits have the same parity and these two bits have different parity. Right? So then where did the error occur? Can you speak up? The third bit, right. So this should be the case where there's an error on bit 3, right? Because that's like the two possibilities that would lead to that would be like 0, 0, 1 or 1, 1, 0, right? So that's why this should correspond to an error on bit 3. What about this one where we have 1, 0? That means these two bits have different parity and these two have the same parity. Bit 1, yeah, so this should be when there's an error on bit 1. And then the last one had better be on bit 2. And that's right, because that's when you know these two things are different and these two things are both different. And under the assumption that there was only one error that occurred, then the only way that that could happen is if this bit had the error. So what we see here is that if we measure what syndrome occurred, if we measure the syndrome, then we find where an error occurred under the assumption that there was either 0 or 1 errors, and now we could go back in and correct that, right? So on the basis of this information, we could go back in and correct. So conditioned on what syndrome we saw, we could go perform some logical operation on some appropriate bit up here that would give us back our state. And this would work if there were 0 or 1 errors. Of course, if there were 2 or 3 errors, it would not do the right thing. But you know that's the best we can hope for. We can't just correct against arbitrary errors. Okay, and so you know the nice thing about this is that really all that we're measuring here is what error occurred under the assumption that there were 0, 1 errors. We're not measuring anything about whether we had a logical 0 or a logical 1, right? So if we had a 0, 0, 0 and no error occurred, we would get the syndrome 0, 0. And if we had a 1, 1, 1 and no error occurred, we would also get this corresponding syndrome. And similarly for all the possibilities, right? If we had 0, 0, 0 and an error occurred on the second bit, then we would get the same syndrome for both 0, 0, 0 and 1, 1, 1, right? So this works for any state psi. Which is good. Okay. So I think maybe the interest of catching back up a little bit, maybe I'll just take a couple of minutes now and talk a little bit about how we'll cope with this problem 3, right? So we've sort of dealt with problems 1 and 2, except that we've only corrected against a very specific kind of error. So now let's think a little bit about what's the more general kind of error we might have to correct against and try to understand, you know, how to deal with that. So if we had just, you know, bit flip errors, but in some other basis, we could do the same kind of error correction, but in some other basis. We could just, perform some unitary transformation to go into the basis where the errors will occur. But the real issue is that, you know, we'll have to correct against errors in more than one basis, and we really have this continuum of errors that we ultimately have to be able to correct for. So how are we going to consider some sort of model of error where we'll be able to correct against arbitrary errors? Okay, so what we want to do is we want to consider the most general error. And what's the most general error that could occur? Well, that would just be some quantum operation that's applied to our quantum state. So rho would just get mapped to some completely positive trace preserving map on rho, where rho is the density matrix of our system. If we want to think about it like this, maybe it's kind of not so clear how to proceed, but any such map could always be realized by some interaction with an environment. So let's look explicitly at what happens if we try to realize something like this through an interaction with an environment. So this can always be realized by unitary interaction with environment. So if we have some quantum state psi for our system, that's maybe initially pure because we're trying to protect, let's say, pure quantum states, and then we take some standard initial state for our environment, which we could just call zero, then we could map that through some unitary interaction between the system and the environment to some arbitrary entangled state, psi prime, of the system and the environment. And if we trace out over the environment, that could always be used to realize any completely positive trace-preserving map like this. So let's to keep things simple, consider the case where the system is just a qubit. And similar considerations will apply to the more general case. All right, so then, what could this look like? So we've got two possibilities. We could have either the state 0 for our system or the state 1 for our system. So if we've got the state 0 for our system, then what happens is that we apply some unitary interaction between the system and the environment, and we'll just get some superposition between a term where we have 0 for the system and some term where we have 1 for the system. So let's write this as gamma 0, 0 times 0 for the system, 0 for the environment, plus gamma 0, 1, 1 for the system, and, I wrote 0 for the environment, but it's not necessarily that. It could just be some general state for the environment. So let me call this phi 0, 0. And then the term where we have 1 for the system could be some general, we could have some general state phi 0, 1 for the environment. Okay, and then the other possibility is that we could have, for a general state psi for the system, there's some branch of the wave function where we could have 1 for the system, 0 for the environment, and then when we apply this unitary interaction with the environment, we could get some term that looks like, gamma 1, 0, 0 for the system, and then some state phi 1, 0 for the environment, and then there's some coefficient for 1 for the system, and then some state for the environment, right? So this is just sort of the most general thing that could happen, and this is really describing any unitary interaction between the system and the environment. So if we have some superposition between 0 and 1, then we would get the corresponding superposition of these states where the system has become entangled with the environment in general. Okay, so let's actually just write that. So if we have alpha 0 plus beta 1 for the system, and then we have our initial state for the environment, this is just going to get mapped to the corresponding linear combination of states, right? So we have alpha, gamma 0, 0, 0 for the system, phi 0, 0 for the environment, plus gamma 0, 1, 1 for the system, phi 0, 1 for the environment, plus beta, gamma 1, 0, 0 for the system, phi 1, 0 for the environment, plus gamma 1, 1, 1 for the system, phi 1, 1 for the environment. Okay, so this is just the most general thing that could happen if we take some arbitrary input state and we interact it with our environment according to this unitary interaction. Okay. So now what you can do, and maybe we won't do the details now, but you can rewrite this in a very similar way to this calculation that you've seen before if you want to analyze how quantum teleportation behaves. You can rewrite this in terms of a different basis of states for the system. Instead of the computational basis, you can always rewrite this using the following states. So psi, x acting on psi, z acting on psi, and let's say xz acting on psi. You could use y acting on psi if you preferred, but this is the way I would do the calculation. So you can rewrite this, and what you will find is that this state, which is just psi for the system and then zero for the environment, will get mapped to some linear combination of each of these possible states for the system and then some corresponding state for the environment. And that state for the environment will be, some linear combination of these environmental states, and it'll involve these coefficients, the gammas. But it won't depend explicitly on the alphas and the betas. The only dependence on the alphas and the betas will be in, the state psi, which appears in these four expressions. So maybe this is an exercise that you can do if you want to fill in some of the details. You can show that this thing will get mapped to some alpha identity for the identity being applied to the system. So psi and then some state that I'll write as phi sub identity plus alpha x psi phi sub x plus alpha z psi phi sub z plus alpha xz psi, and I also mean for x to be applied here, z to be applied here, and xz to be applied here. Right? Okay, so there's a little bit of, algebra that you have to do to get from here to here. You should, you should basically just, rewrite these things in terms of these environmental states and these coefficients. And there's always some way of doing that, regardless of whatever these gammas might be. Okay, so, so for example, maybe I'll just tell you if you want to check what you get, if you're going to actually do this, this calculation. So like, alpha I times phi I, you should find that this is a half gamma 0, 0, phi 0, 0, plus gamma 1, 1, phi 1, 1. So that's what I mean by alpha I phi I, and you can work out a similar expression for each of the other terms. So there's no explicit dependence on alpha and beta in these things. So you can just work out what all of these different environmental states are. So what this says is that for any completely arbitrary interaction we could have between the system and the environment, we can always interpret that as the possibility of just four unitary operations that could be applied to the qubit, right? There's a term here where nothing is done to the qubit, so no error occurred. There's a term where there was an x error. There's a term where there's a z error, and there's a term where there's both an x and a z error. So, and the amplitudes for those things to happen, would depend on, you could compute what this alpha I is, it's the norm of this state, and you could compute what those probabilities are for some particular system-environment interaction. But regardless of what the system-environment interaction is, you can always rewrite it like this, right? So what this says is that actually, if we had a way to correct against X errors, so in other words, bit flip errors, and z errors, or in other words, you could think of those as phase flip errors, right? So x errors in the Hadamard basis. And if you could also correct against the possibility that both of those errors would occur, that you would have a z error and then an x error, then this will actually allow you to correct against a completely arbitrary error, right? So, it seems like, sort of on the surface, we need to correct against a continuum of errors. But in fact, we only have to be able to correct against these four specific errors for one qubit. And if we can do that, then there's a sense in which we can correct against arbitrary errors. Of course, we'll only try to do that where, in the case where the probabilities of those errors occurring is small, and then it's unlikely that we would have multiple errors. But still, if we could correct against low weight x and z errors, and also xz errors, then that's going to allow us to handle the case of arbitrary errors where some error occurs with low probability. So that's sort of the idea. We haven't actually seen yet how to correct a genuine quantum error correcting code that will correct against not just bit flip errors, right? So far we have just this bit flip error correcting code. But what we'll see next time is how to write down a code that will correct against these other kinds of errors, and we'll only have to correct against these these you know, this small finite list of errors in order to, in some sense, correct against you know, any general low weight error that could occur. So we'll see that next time, and then I'll say something you know, so beyond that, I'll say something about more general error correcting codes, and we'll talk about how you can do not just storage of quantum information, but actually quantum computation in the presence of noise. So that's what's called fault-tolerant quantum computation. Okay, so sorry to go a bit over. I guess I should stop there. Are there any last questions? Okay, great. So see you tomorrow.